All right, then. Yowza, Friday at 5 p.m.
Yowza.
Yeah. That's how I start my happy hour.
Yeah. Welcome to WHPC.
Mm-hmm. I'm Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan. We have the next hour to spend with you. We call the show How Music Changed on Fridays, where we go through a variety of topics. We actually have a list of 250 that we plan on covering in our lifetime and part of the next lifetime.
Yeah, good luck with that.
As well, because it's going to take that long to do it. Right now, we just started a new topic last week, and it takes some of these topics take a good number of shows, which is why to do 250 of them could take two or three lifetimes to really complete our list. But we're doing our best, and it basically gives me reason to want to live forever. So I have a sense of obligation.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, it's a sense of obligation to get it done.
You do have a huge sense of obligation.
So we have just started covering the history of Simon and Garfunkel just last week. That was part one. In part one, we covered the early pop years and the doo-wop years of the...
That's so weird.
...of the duo together and apart. Yeah, it was very strange in a sense, considering how we know... what we know of their music now, it was in a very different place in the early part of their career. And it's amazing. It's fairly remarkable to see how suddenly they would suddenly change direction and move toward folk music. But in fact, I think we even commented on that. Like, what? just overnight, it seemed, is what happened. But the truth is, if you were going to be honest about it, in the early 60s, most college-aged kids in America found themselves abandoning pop music and rock and roll for the trend of folk music. Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel were just no different. Turning on a dime, Paul didn't have to worry any longer about the impossibility of him trying to compete with Elvis Presley. And he was able to sublimate his love for street corner doo-wop by instead, writing songs that fit in with the scene that had become prevalent, most particularly right here in New York, in Greenwich Village. From a commercial perspective, the folk scene quickly started to flourish on college campuses all over America. And it welcomed anybody who was willing to, gather at Hootenannies, as they were being called, to play guitar and sing songs that conveyed a sense of purpose. That was more or less, in a sentence, the definition of what folk more or less was, the throes of birth, so to speak.
It's infancy.
Right. But in New York, the folk scene was a lot different, to be honest. It was much more competitive, for one. First of all, you had Bob Dylan standing at the center of the scene in downtown New York, which is intimidating enough. If not, I don't even know what could be more intimidating than that, really, just to start it off. But Dylan himself is surrounded on all sides by both acolytes and pioneers who he respected, and all of them were competing, for attention. It was this harsh environment where the gentle harmonies of, Simon and Garfunkel were expected to compete with Irish fighting songs, immigrant ballads, Appalachian folk songs, all the meat and potatoes that made up the folk music in especially in the New York scene. It was a toughest brand of folk music. So
it was such a confluence of different styles.
Right, and it all came together. And Bob Dylan, of course, beginning to change it all, almost on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Constantly
surprise.
Evolving and evolving and evolving until people didn't even know where to turn. Everybody else was, busy being themselves, and Bob was busy reinventing himself constantly. So it must have been a daunting time for a pair of middle-class college boys from Queens to suddenly show up in Greenwich Village and try to hawk their wares, so to speak. And that's exactly where this show picks up. Now, where we left off with part one, they were playing at basically one of those Hootenannies, a free show downtown, and Tom Wilson happened to be there at Folk City, and he had seen them, and Paul Simon managed to, Tom Wilson basically asked if he could buy one of their songs.
Right.
And Paul was able to more or less parlay that into an audition, and hoping that it would go well. And that's exactly where we are now. Now, as we go through the show, I have a book by Mark Elliott called Paul Simon, A Life. And it serves me well for the stories that it tells and for giving me a sense of the history. But I've got to say that it seems at times that the writer, Mark Elliott, has a bit of an agenda in his writing. And I will try to avoid that because I don't want to do that. I've got, you know, I don't know whether or not Mark does or does not have respect for his subjects here. But it seems that at times it seems to be a bit pointed. So I've done my best to jump through the book and try to stick to the things that more or less are factual or certainly, you know, it may be subjective.
Not colored.
Only, right, to help convey the story without being overtly prejudicial. I try not to, I will absolutely try to not do that. But nevertheless, this book, Paul Simon Alive, is the source for most of my words as we move through the story and the music from this point in time, which is 1964, right around now. Their audition for Columbia went well, thanks in part to the skills of house engineer Roy Haley, who happened to have one of the sharpest ears in the business. Perhaps the fact that he grew up as the son of the Roy Haley who provided the singing voice for all of the Mighty Mouse cartoons had something to do with it. Haley provided the perfect mix for the audition that he caught on tape. Incidentally, also in the control room that same day was Jim McGuinn, who would soon change his name to Roger McGuinn and hit it, I don't know why, and soon hit it big for Columbia with the Byrds, a group that more than any other helped popularize, coincidentally, Bob Dylan's music.
Absolutely.
Now, satisfied with the results of the recording and the audition and at Tom Wilson's urging, Columbia signed Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. Now, Paul quickly set about to organize 12 or 13 songs that would be needed for the first album. But as they were going through the songs, it turns out that only 5 of Paul's original songs were deemed good enough to be included on the debut album. So the rest of the album consisted mostly of traditional folk songs, not unlike the stuff that you might have been hearing by some of the other artists who were performing in Greenwich Village on Bleecker Street at that time, including the opening track from the album. When it came out, it was called Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. Here is side one, track one from that album entitled You Can Tell the World.
Tell the world about this. You can tell the nation about that. Tell them what the master has done. Tell them what the gospel has come. Tell them how the victory's been won. He brought joy, 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 joy into my heart. Well, my Lord spoke so well. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Talk about the flames of burning hell. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Now my Lord spoke so well. Yes, it did. Talk about the children of Israel. Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Brought joy, joy, joy into my heart. Well, you can tell the world about this. You can tell the nation about that. Tell them what the master has done. Tell them that the gospel has come. Tell them that the victory's been won. He brought joy, 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 joy into my heart. Well, my Lord spoke to me. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Talking about the man from Galilee. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. My Lord spoke to me. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Talking about a man from Galilee. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He brought joy, joy, joy into my heart. Well, you can't tell the world about this. You can tell the nation about that. Tell them what the master has done. Brought joy, 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 joy into my heart. Well, I don't know, but I've been told. Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Streets of heaven are paved with gold. Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Now the Jordan River is chilly and wide. Yes, it did. Yes, it did. I got a home on the other side. can tell the world about this. You can tell the nation about that. Tell them what the master has done. Tell them that the gospel has come. Tell them that the victory's been won. He brought joy, 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 joy into my heart.
I can only imagine what Paul's mother said when she heard that.
His good Jewish mom and dad. Well, they were musicians, so they probably didn't worry about it at all one way or the other. I don't think
this
neither
is true.
Paul's family nor Art's family were...
Oh, Paul.
they weren't practicing Jews, I think would be the best, probably okay. The best way to say it. But it is interesting to think how many Christian songs
yes.
there are that are in the folk pantheon. And... how it, you know, it really is irrelevant what your own religion is to sing these songs. You're singing them more or less.
I guess so, yeah. You're just singing it for the history.
Yeah, for the sake of history, for the sake of the song, maybe for even just for the sake of the melody. Most of them is because you're trying to convey some sense of purpose. So I guess that a sense of faith, whether it is overtly Christian or not, might be the purpose.
Perhaps.
But don't want to read into it too much.
It's worth a shot.
Right. The fact is, though, that is where the album opened, or how the album opened. The album, as I said, was called Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m., and it was recorded in three separate daytime sessions on March 10th, March 17th, and March 31st. Now, to fill out the sound of just one guitar, since Paul was the only musician of the pair, Barry Kornfeld, a friend of Paul's from the Village, was brought in to add a second guitar, and they brought in Bill Lee. Tom Wilson brought him in to play bass. It's possible that Kornfeld might have also helped out with some of the songwriting because he soon became the co-publisher of Paul Simon's music.
Interesting.
Right. Since the scene is Bleecker Street, and we had mentioned that, I think it was in last week when I said that Paul had written three songs for his, basically for that hootenanny that they were playing at, because that was how they were going to. They had a 15-minute slot, and about three songs was about right. So we played once. We played The Sound of Silence,
yes.
which was the song, and I think we also played He Was My Brother. Here's a third song that Paul had written that did make the album. Rather interestingly, it's a song overtly, again, just, I keep using that word, about the scene in Greenwich Village. It's simply called Bleecker Street.
Fogs rolling in off the East River bank, like a shroud, it covers Bleecker Street. Fills the alleys where men sleep, hides the shepherd from the sheep. Voices leaking from a sad cafe, smiling faces try to understand. I saw a shadow touch a shadow's hand on Bleecker Street. The poet reads his crooked rhyme, holy, holy sacrament. $30 pays your rent on Bleecker Street. I heard a church bell softly chime in amen. It's a long road to Canaan on Bleecker Street.
song that doesn't seem to have much life. It seems like it's more or less been forgotten in Paul's catalog.
It's funny. It's pretty enough, though.
On the first album, I would say it was one of the best songs. It is a very pretty song, but pretty much it seems as if it's like more or less drifted into the ether.
Mm-hmm.
But it did prove that Paul very quickly did become a rather talented writer of
yes.
folk material and also an excellent guitar player. He sounds great. His guitar playing is really good on that track, I think. Now, you have to. This is the thing that you have to try to understand now to really make today's show work. Simon and Garfunkel got signed to Columbia Records in the early 60s. This is the same label that had signed Bob Dylan. On his turf, Simon and Garfunkel are now signed to the same label, playing in, you know, jockeying to play in the same clubs, in the same,
right.
same market and everything else. It set up a sort of
rivalry,
an implied rivalry, an implied sense of competition that wasn't real, certainly not one that Paul would wish upon himself. You know, absolutely not something that he would wish upon himself, but one that was inevitable to anybody else who would look at it from the outside in a superficial manner. You couldn't help but wonder or sense that there would have to be something going on in the minds of the protagonists, you know? So and to make matters worse, at this point in time, it just seemed as though every artist who was getting signed to Columbia Records was more or less expected, if not forced, to include at least one Bob Dylan song on their album. You know?
So Bob Dylan could cry all the way to the bank.
Right. I mean, now that they had Bob and he's a songwriter, Peter, Paul, and Mary were on Columbia, so they had recorded Blowin' in the Wind and they struck gold with it. It became a huge hit for them. So now that Simon and Garfunkel are signed on Columbia, of course Columbia is going to more or less force them to choose a Bob Dylan song to round out their albums. Say, Paul, you've only got five. One of your songs is going to be our songwriter, our artist. Pick a Paul Simon, pick a Bob Dylan song. So they did. They decided to do a version of The Times They Are A-Changin', which they did well enough, a pretty decent, straightforward version of it. It didn't add anything, didn't really
right.
subtract anything either. It was really more or less just another commercial for Dylan
right.
and his songwriting prowess to put the attention back on to Dylan for what it was that he represented as the head honcho kingpin songwriter of the folk movement.
And they didn't have to send a royalty check to a different company.
right, exactly. Just maybe a different publisher.
Right.
We'll get through maybe a bit more of the album as we go through the show. But I've got another track I want to play from the album, which is the title track, the song that ends the album. It was another Paul Simon original called, as we said, the title of the album and the song is Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m.
I can hear the soft breathing of the girl that I love as she lies here beside me asleep with the night, and her hair in a fine mist floats on my pillow, reflecting the glow of the winter moonlight. She is soft, she is warm, but my heart remains heavy, and I watch as her breasts gently rise, gently fall. For I know with the first light of dawn I'll be leaving, and tonight will be all I have left to recall. Oh, what have I done? Why have I done it? I've committed a crime, broken the law. For $25 and pieces of silver,
I held up and robbed a hard liquor store. My life seems unreal, my crime an illusion, a scene badly written in which I must play. Yet I know as I gaze at my young love beside me, the morning is just a few hours away.
Another very pretty song.
Way sweet.
Which, of course, as I said, in the folk scene of New York City could have been problematic. And I mean, I'm not trying to make it sound as though the folk guys in Greenwich Village were like,
were
gang members or anything. But you've got the Clancy brothers and such who are, you know, these Irish drinking guys, you know, in their sweaters and ready to basically to fight and brawl. And Dylan, right, like I said, running the scene. And something comes along which seems so precious. It must have been, I don't know. I try to imagine it. And I guess what I can really do is just read the story as it, you know, from excerpts of Mark Elliott's book now for what happens at this point. The album was finished. Columbia set up a showcase performance for the duo at Folk City. These prepaid and papered showcases were gold for the club owner, Mike Porco, as the label, hoping to create some word of mouth, picked up the entire tab for these events. Although the album wasn't due out for months, it still had to be mixed, artwork completed, and promotional events put in place, the purpose of the showcase was to officially introduce Simon and Garfunkel to the world. Only, throughout the recording process, nobody was sure what to call them. Someone suggested Art and Paul, but they quickly discovered another duo was using that name, oddly enough. From the outset, Paul was adamant, no more fake names. We heard a bunch of them last week.
Right.
Tom and Jerry, no more Canes, no more, you know, Gars, Artie Gar. It was going to be Simon and Garfunkel, or it was going to be nothing. For its part, Columbia pushed hard for the duo to consider using something else, reminding the boys that even Dylan had left his ethnic Zimmerman behind. For Dylan, of course. Tom Wilson, however, agreed with Paul and appealed directly to Norman Adler, the second vice president of Columbia Records, who was also Jewish, to make the final decision. "This is 1964," he declared at the meeting, which was attended by Paul, Wilson, Adler, label president Goddard Lieberson, and John Hammond. Adler then stood up and added, as if declaring war, "It's Simon and Garfunkel. Next case."
Done.
On March 31st, Louis Bass, an observer of the scene, actually was at Folk City for the debut performance of Simon and Garfunkel. The date was March 31 in 1964. And he recalls the night this way. "I remember Simon and Garfunkel performing Sound of Silence for the first time at Folk City. They sing it as some sort of college reunion. The reason was, in order to fill the house, Paul and Artie had invited a lot of their friends from Queen College and the fraternity house. At that time, I never thought they would make it. They didn't sound as good as some of the other acts. It was the first time they tested out publicly. They went over well because it was all their friends. Meanwhile, Robert Shelton, Dylan's champion, he was the New York Times critic who had written that article on Bob Dylan that had more or less broken Dylan wide open, mm-hmm. and was the reason he had gotten signed in the first place. Or Robert Shelton, who by now had gained a side bit of fame for just having written his New York Times rave of Dylan, and he had been elevated to the status of seer of the folk scene, was also there that night to see what the fuss manufactured by Columbia's P&R team was all about. And he wasn't impressed either."
Hmm.
"Simon and Garfunkel were uptown guys, Queens guys. This is his words now, the words of Robert Shelton. I was struck by a kind of Mickey Mouse, timid, contrived side, Shelton later said. And of course, through Dylan, Dave Van Ronk, and all those guys, what was really being created was a rough, natural, dirty sound. Simon and Garfunkel sounded very suburban. Simon always struck me as a suburban type of Dylan. Turns out the man himself, Bob Dylan, was there that night, standing alongside Shelton, who had, since that New York Times review, become his buddy. Dylan's mere presence was an acknowledgement that Simon and Garfunkel were being pushed hard by the label that they now shared. Indeed, they were the only other so-called village act that had managed to get signed to Columbia, something that Dylan, never known for his generosity or desire to share the spotlight, probably didn't appreciate.
Right.
Here is Robert Shelton's actual recollection of what happened that night. Dylan and I were at Folk City as Simon and Garfunkel came on. Simon cast a hostile look Dylan's way. On stage, Simon and Garfunkel began to sing ethereal choir boy harmonies that sounded seriously out of place at Gertie's, home of weather-beaten ethnic songs. At the bar, Bob and I, who had been doing quite a bit of drinking, had an advanced case of giggles over nothing. We weren't laughing at the performance, but Simon was furious. Afterward, Simon acted as though there were a Dylan cabal against him. While Dylan tended to ignore Simon, although Garfunkel never joined the one-way vendetta, Simon did seem determined to elevate himself at Dylan's expense. On their first album, Simon and Garfunkel recorded The Times They Are A-Changin'. While looking forward to Simon and Garfunkel's second album, Simon was only emulating Dylan's alienation, protest, and brotherhood, but also directly satirizing Dylan. Simon's track called A Simple Desultory Philippic was a vicious burlesque. Its harmonica playing and shouts for Albert, which was the name of Dylan's manager, left little doubt about its target. Bob Spitz, one of Dylan's many biographers, also wrote about the incident, confirming that Simon held a long-standing grudge against Dylan because he had talked loudly through the entire show. Despite or because of Dylan's obvious disdain or jealousy or anger or drunken rudeness or whatever, neither Simon nor Garfunkel nor the executives from Columbia were impressed with their debut, and it was decided among them that it might be better to keep the duo away from the performance stage until their album was actually released. They did one or two more nights at the Gaslight that had already been booked, with even more dismal results than their debut at Folk City.
Oh, dear.
Dave Van Ronk remembered those Gaslight shows and believes that Simon and Garfunkel were signed to Columbia because they still had some leftover pull from their Tom and Jerry days. Dave Van Ronk's words. When they first showed up, they were in a pretty tough situation because they had already had a top 40 hit as teenagers, and as far as the music was concerned, they were over the hill. But the moldy fig wing of the folk world, that's what they called the old school folk players, despised them as pop singers. I remember hearing them down at the Gaslight and nobody would listen. I thought they were damn good. But the people who wanted to hear Mississippi John Hurt and Doc Boggs wanted no part of Simon and Garfunkel. Sounds of Silence had actually become a running joke. For a while there, it was only necessary to start singing Hello Darkness, My Old Friend, and everybody would crack up.
Oh, boy.
A week.
Rough crowd.
Really. A week after their less than spectacular debut, Simon, still smarting over the Dylan incident and subsequent condescending reception at the Gaslight, became convinced that the album was going to bomb, and he didn't want to be around to see it. With Artie opting once more to return to classes at Columbia, Paul flew off by himself to Europe, eventually winding up in Paris. The song that Paul had written about this experience and about his feelings, I think more or less point out that there has to be a lot of truth to this story. The song is called A Simple Desultory Philippic, which is a highfalutin words. If you look it up in the dictionary, what it basically translates as into is a simple, aimless discourse full of bitter condemnation.
A simple desultory philippic, or how I was Lyndon Johnsoned into submission. I was Union Jacked, Kerouac, John Birch, Stop and Search, Rolling Stone, and Beatle till I'm blind. I've been Ayn Randed, nearly branded, communist, cause I'm left-handed. That's the hand I use, well, never mind. I've been Walt Disney, Diz Disley, John Lennon, Krishna Menon, Walter Brennan, punched out Cassius Clay. I have heard the truth from Lenny Bruce, and all my wealth won't buy me health, so I smoke a pint of tea a day. I knew a man, his brain's too small, he couldn't think nothing at all. He's not the same as you and me, doesn't dig poetry. He's so unhip that when you say Dylan, he thinks you're talking about Dylan Thomas, whoever he is. Man ain't got no culture. But it's all right, Ma. It's just something I learned over in England. I've been James Joyce, Rolls Royce, Mick Jagger, Silver Dagger. Andy Warhol, won't you please come home? I've been mother, father, aunt and uncle, Tom Wilson, Art Garfunkel, Barry Kornfeld's mother's on the phone. When in London, do as I do, find yourself a friendly haiku. Go to sleep for 10 or 15 years.
Got that out of his system.
Yeah.
Recorded another version of the song later on, which is even odder. You think that he would have just let that one go, but he revisits it, as we will, moving forward.
That'll be for another show.
Well, where were we? Well, one night after playing a set in the metro in Paris, Paul happened to meet a fellow free traveler sitting next to him on a park bench. The young man's name was Dave McCausland, and he was English. They got to talking, and McCausland told Paul that he was the proprietor of a folk club in the Railway Hotel in Brentwood, Essex, the county to the east of London, and that if Paul was ever passing through, there was an engagement with his name on it waiting for him. That's all Paul needed to know. He immediately flew to London and worked his way to Essex. He arrived there on April 11, 1964. So this is happening very quickly. This is just 2 weeks after the Greenwich Village debacle. And he found himself in the middle of the peak of Beatlemania, which had obviously energized the British music scene in a way that nothing and nobody had ever seen before. Dave McCausland warmly welcomed Paul to his Brentwood Folk Club at the Railway Hotel in the back room of the pub, where he quickly became a nightly fixture, accompanying himself on acoustic guitar. One thing that Paul noticed immediately was the politeness of the crowd, the difference of the British audience compared to the New York audience. There was none of what Dave Van Ronk had described as the village's dirty scene, the competitive hostility that served as the underpinning for the singers of songs that called for social justice in the village of the early 60s. And it was there when he met Kathy Chitty. She was a pretty office secretary in the daytime and at night the ticket taker at Dave McCausland's club. She lived in Brentwood with her parents. Paul met her the first night that he performed in Essex, and after she watched him from the back of the club, listening raptly to every song, afterward she went boldly to his dressing room and introduced herself. Whatever young love at first sight is, according to those who were there, the two of them fell into it fast, hard, and deep. After that first night, they became inseparable. And with each set Paul sang at the club, he appeared to be singing directly to and only for her. Soon enough, however, the desire to try to play his music in London proved too strong for Paul to resist. And after a tearful, on her part, farewell and a promise on his part that he would return, in the spring of 1964, Paul set out alone to find his place in the musical storm of England's cultural shift. Paul arrived in London the very week the Rolling Stones' eponymous debut had knocked With the Beatles out of first place on the British charts. Rather remarkably coincidentally, that's the exact album that we just covered 2 days ago on our Wednesday show, the England's newest hitmakers album.
Yeah, well, things work out.
In his absence from Kathy, Paul was compelled to write songs about his experience, and he wrote a rather beautiful love song for her, simply entitled Kathy's Song.
I hear the drizzle of the rain like a memory. Soft and warm, continuing, tapping on my roof and walls. And from the shelter of my mind, through the window of my eyes, I gaze beyond the rain-drenched streets to England, where my heart lies. My mind's distracted and diffused. My thoughts are many miles away. They lie with you. You're asleep and kiss you when you start your day. And a song I was writing is left undone. I don't know why I spend my time writing songs I can't believe, with words that tear and strain to rhyme. So you see, I have come to doubt all that I once held as true. I stand alone without beliefs. The only truth I know is you. And as I watch the drops of rain weave their weary paths and die, I know that I am like the there, but for the grace of you go I.
I might say that's a beautiful song. I would say it might be Paul Simon's first truly great song. Really powerful love song. Great honesty in the lyrics. Lots of emotion. I just love the way that you can tell that it's coming from the heart. And it's funny because Kathy is has remained a muse for him for almost. There was at least one song on each of the first four Simon and Garfunkel albums, which was inspired by her, going all the way up to Bookends. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping, off of America. He just kept returning to her as like a muse, as I said.
Yes.
Well, that September, Tom Wilson called Paul back to the United States for final preparations before the release of Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. Paul, reluctant to leave London, brought Kathy to the United States with him. And when he arrived, instead of contacting Tom Wilson or even Artie, he decided to take her on a 5-day motor trip, just the two of them,
oh,
just
great.
Show her as much of the country as he could before he got down to the business of the album. Out of that excursion came the road song America, in which Paul confesses to Kathy while she is sleeping that he is lost. The song implication being that he isn't talking about where he is, but about who he is. Anyway, the album was finally released on October 19th, 1964, and sold a dismal 3,000 copies. None of its songs received much exposure on the radio, and the label could not place the duo on any TV shows. To anybody in the rest of the country, the album sounded too New York, while to the Village crowd and its followers, it wasn't New York enough. Either way, it couldn't compete for airtime against the Beatles, Roy Orbison, the Beach Boys, or even Bob Dylan. By Christmas, the album was declared dead by Columbia, and Paul, convinced that he had no future in America, returned to England, certain that this time he would remain with Kathy in London forever. Upon his arrival, the first thing that he did was to sublease a room for himself in a small house near Belsize Park in North London. As it happened, Martin Carthy, a folk-singing traditionalist, also lived there, and the two became friends. And Carthy helped point Paul in the direction of clubs and pubs where he might find work as a singer, and transport cafes where the food was cheap. In a good week, he was able to earn as much as £20, which covered all of his expenses.
Awesome.
At this point in time, in England, Paul started using the name Paul Kane again. And apparently nobody knew that Paul Kane was also Paul Simon, one half of Simon and Garfunkel, and that he had a major label album in the States. No one in the States knew about it either, or so it seemed, and he preferred it that way. Eventually, he discovered that Lorna Music, a small music publishing company in London's West End, had licensed a song of his from E.B. Marks Music in America, Paul's publisher, under the pseudonym Paul Kane. The song, Carlos Dominguez, had been recorded by Val Dunican on his latest album and had done fairly well, selling about 90,000 units. One afternoon, Paul decided to pay a visit to Lorna Music to thank them for using his song. Les Lowe graciously invited Paul to come have tea and talk about his music. As Lowe later remembered, this young American sat there in our tiny cramped office, took off his duffel coat, took out his guitar, and started to play strange songs. I was very impressed, and I had no doubt that Paul's work was unique, so I took him to meet Alan Paramore. That meeting resulted in Lorna Music signing Paul to a British publishing and recording contract. The first step was to make a few demos, which they did at Regent Sound Studios on Denmark Street. That's exactly where the Rolling Stones recorded their first album, as I remember. The demos were passed around and led to several gigs in the Soho section of London. That May, Lou managed to get Paul a record deal for a single on the Oriole label. Paul chose to record He Was My Brother, which had been on Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., which we played last week, and his own version of Carlos Dominguez using the name of Jerry Landis. Back to the fake names again. The publishing credits remained as originally registered to Paul Kane. So they're all Paul Simon, but the artist and the publishing are different names, but they mean him. Here is that track, Carlos Dominguez.
Carlos Dominguez, an unhappy man, always running away. What are you searching for, Carlos Dominguez? Why do you cry every day? I am searching for something that I cannot find. I look for a way I might find peace of mind. I run 'cause I'm lost, I'm afraid, so I cry. You ask why I search, there are many reasons why. Carlos Dominguez, an unhappy man, always running away. What are you searching for, Carlos Dominguez? Why do you cry every day? I search for a truth all I found was a lie. I look for eternity, but I find all men die. I'm looking for answers, but I find only fate. I'm searching for love, all I find in this world is hate. Carlos Dominguez, an unhappy man, always running away. What are you searching for, Carlos Dominguez? Why do you cry every day?
Poor Carlos Dominguez.
rather obscure early single by Paul Simon there called Carlos Dominguez. Now back in New York, imagine Art Garfunkel's surprise when he gets a phone call from Paul Simon asking him to come to England to hang out for the summer. Having finished his spring semester classes at Columbia, he was energized by the sound of Paul's voice and the stories of how easy and fun life was in London, so he decided to take him up on the offer. Besides being housemates, Paul and Martin Carthy ran into each other frequently on the pub tour circuit. They had gotten to know each other's music and often shared songs. Carthy had originally learned a traditional song called Scarborough Fair about the festivals in the lovely seaside resort of Scarborough on Yorkshire's craggy northeastern coast, from an Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger book of traditional songs called The Singing Island. Carthy often played it for Paul, who fell in love with its lilting melody and spent weeks trying to give it a more contemporary sound, using Artie's high harmonies to infuse it with a spectral beauty and a contemporary Everly Brothers feel that Carthy's solo vocals couldn't match. The summer flew by, and as August wound down, Artie announced that he had to go back to New York to start classes at Columbia. Paul said he understood, but more than that, to everyone's surprise, no one more than Kathy, Paul said that he was going to go back too. He was under pressure from his parents to return to school and his studies to be a lawyer. Whatever the reason, guilt, club fatigue, homesickness, he also loved the good side of being with Artie, his best friend growing up and his singing and songwriting partner. With his wounds sufficiently licked, Paul now felt ready to rejoin the real world and leave his dream of being a London-based folk music star behind. For the last night in London, Paul, Kathy, and Artie went to the Flamingo Club on Wardour Street to see the Ian Campbell Group perform. However, by showtime, the group had failed to arrive, and the club's promoter, desperate to put something on stage, asked Paul, by now a well-known local performer, if he could do a last-minute fill-in. Without hesitation, Paul took his guitar, as he always carried it with him, and went up on the small stage. He performed a number of his songs that were to appear on his British debut album, simply entitled Songbook, songs including Leaves That Are Green, which appeared also on Sound of Silence, and a number of other songs, and this song called The Church is Burning.
A church is burning, the flames rise higher, like hands that are praying, aglow in the sky. Like hands that are praying, the fire is saying, you can burn down my churches, but I shall be free. Three hooded men through the back roads did creep, torches in their hands while the village lie asleep. Down to the church where just hours before voices were singing and hands were beating and saying, I won't be a slave anymore. And the church is burning, the flames rise higher, like hands that are praying,
Like hands that are praying, the fire is saying, you can burn down my churches, but I shall be free. Three hooded men, their hands lit the spark, then they faded in the night, and they vanished in the dark. And in the cold light of morning, there is nothing that remains but the ashes of a Bible and a can of kerosene. And a church is burning. The flames rise higher, like hands that are praying, a glow in the sky. Like hands that are praying, the fire is saying, you can burn down my churches, but I shall be free. Church is more than just timber and stone, and freedom is a dark road when you walk in it alone. But the future is now, and it's time to take a stand, so the lost bells of freedom can ring out in my land. And a church is burning. The flames rise higher, like hands that are praying, a glow in the sky. Like hands that are praying, the fire is saying, you can burn down my churches, but I shall be free.
Performed at their farewell performance when they were leaving England to come back to America. That song was taken from Paul Simon's first album, Songbook. Now, Artie was in the audience with him when this had all happened. So Paul, at this point in time, basically to make it really worthwhile, invited Artie up onto the stage. Don't forget, they had an album in America.
Right.
It wasn't selling, but they did have an album in America at this point in time. And one of the tracks on that album, Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., was this beautiful harmony, I guess an old Christian song called Benedictus. And they performed this together at that same spontaneous performance.
Thank you.
song that just provided a taste of what was to come, but with the harmonies between Art Garfunkel and Paul Simon. Now, the British album, Songbook, did not sell any better out of the gate than Wednesday morning, 3 a.m., but for Paul, it definitely provided at least some sense of reward because he was proud of the album. He's writing the music on the album. It wasn't being compared to anybody else.
He wasn't forced to do any Dylan covers.
Right. It was basically him being allowed to be himself. And it righted a lot of the wrongs that had been happening with the first album in the United States. So he when he left England, he had a sense of pride, at least he'd accomplished something. And we'll play one more song from the album Songbook, and then we'll come back next week to discuss what happens upon Paul's return to the States. The song then that remains from the album called Songbook, we'll play this track called I Am a Rock.
A winter's day in a deep and dark December, I am gazing from my window to the streets below on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. I am a rock, I am an island. I built walls, a fortress deep and mighty that none may penetrate. I have no need of friendship. Friendship causes pain. It's laughter and it's loving I disdain. I am a rock, I am an island. Don't talk of love. Well, I've heard the word before. It's sleeping in my memory, and I won't disturb the slumber of feelings that have died. If I never loved, I never would have cried. I am a rock, I am an island. I have my books and my poetry to protect me. I am shielded in my armor, hiding in my room, safe within my womb. I touch no one and no one touches me. I am a rock, I am an island. And a rock can feel no pain, and an island never cries.